That is the sound from a packed pub in Temple Bar in Dublin last night. If you're on social media, I'm sure you saw this yesterday. It was circulated quite widely and it went viral yesterday evening. I have to tell you, I am livid about it. And I know lots of people share that anger this morning. Now look, I'm not stupid. I know that none of the people who were in that pub singing that song last night are listening to me here at 8 o'clock on News Talk Breakfast on a Sunday morning. But nonetheless, let me say this. What they did last night, going into that packed pub, despite the fact that we have heard this advice again and again, that we need to keep our distance from one another, was selfish and it was completely reckless. And what it did was it gave a massive two fingers to all of the hardworking, heroic healthcare staff in this country who are trying to keep the show on the road at the minute. There's people coming off shifts right now. There's people starting them. There's people who haven't had a day off in weeks. People are putting their lives on the line to help keep the rest of us safe if we are unfortunate enough to get coronavirus. And I just can't help but wonder, do those people in the pub last night, do they have families? Do they have parents? Do they have grandparents? Do they not know someone who has had cancer or who has any of the myriad of health conditions that we know make people more at risk when they get coronavirus? And do they not have a conscience? Because it seems to me that they just don't. And we heard yesterday that loads of pubs have decided to close. They made the difficult decision to do so. They just know that it's not possible for them to follow the guidelines. And a reminder of those guidelines, it is that there will be 6 feet between you and someone else. So they're the social distancing guidelines that we have been given. Loads of pubs know that that's not practical. So they made the decision to close. And I have no doubt that we are going to have to make a decision to close all pubs, and that decision should come today. If not today, it should come tomorrow, and it should come before St. Patrick's Day, because clearly some of us are willing to play by the rules and some people clearly aren't. And look, I have an 8-year-old at home, and if she's willing to accept her new reality, not seeing grandparents, not seeing cousins, not seeing friends, no normal life for the next while, then I definitely think that people can forfeit the pub if it means that we might have some chance of flattening this curve, because it is everyone's problem and some people just haven't grasped that, and we all have to have a part to play in it. So I just hope a decision is made to close the pubs before St. Patrick's Day. I've no doubt we're going to see a repeat of those scenes in Temple Bar if that doesn't happen. I do want to know what you think this morning. Let me know. Maybe you were in a pub somewhere around the country, a smaller pub with less number of people, where you were able to keep your distance from one another, and maybe what happened in Temple Bar last night has ruined that for everybody else. But let me know. 53106 for your text this morning, or do get us on Twitter at BreakfastNT. What was your biggest fear when you got that call, or when you thought that possibly his sentence would be reduced? What ran through your mind?
He's going to come get me. The fact that I lived outside of Letterkenny and not in it was a minor comfort that he probably wouldn't be able to find me.
Mm.
I was walking around town the next day and I was seeing Keith Hearn everywhere.
Were you afraid he'd rape somebody else?
Yeah, and me, and kill me. I've said many times that I would rather he killed me than me living with the fact that I was raped. And I knew that he would do that to someone else.
What is the one thing you would like to see change in how we deal with rapists in this country? Something that would have changed maybe the experience that you had, while nothing can take away what happened?
Minimum sentencing. Minimum sentencing, and none of this, oh, we'll take 3 years off for pleading guilty. I don't care. He pled guilty. He still raped me. Like, he got 12 years. There's no healing in a 12-year sentence for me. And he might be at 9, so there's no healing in a 9-year sentence.
Yeah, I mean, I've spoken to an awful lot of people who have been victims of other crimes, and, you know, family members who maybe somebody in their family has been murdered, and mm-hmm. I've spoken to them about parole and sentencing a lot over the past couple of months. And exactly what you say there, their call, the one thing they would like to change is, again, minimum sentencing, because they cannot stress enough the fear of looking over your shoulder. Mm-hmm. So like getting a day in court behind you and under your belt and hearing of a sentence, but that's really only the start of the process. And then you just never know when the call is going to come in to say, actually, that's, you know, that's been reduced, or he'll be out in such years. Whereas if there was minimum sentencing brought in, there is a hope that victims or survivors could park something for a certain amount of years at least before they would have to sort of address it again.
Yeah, it's that and the way people go about these court cases as well, like the stuff that should be allowed in, like what people are wearing, whether or not they were drinking. Like the Me Too movement started 2 years ago, more or less exactly 2 years ago, and we're still hearing, what were you wearing? What were you drinking? Were you in a dark place?
Did you hear that?
I did. I was trying to go back to college, and one of the access officers asked me, because I was looking for extra help in the coming years, well, what were you wearing? Jesus, were you drinking? And I was like, nope, totally sober. And I was wearing a jeans and t-shirt. I was in my staff t-shirt. I didn't see anything wrong with it, to be honest, but my mum was sitting beside me and she was literally shaking.
With anger?
With anger, with sadness. She just... My mum couldn't understand why someone would ask a 23-year-old what were they wearing, as if it was their fault. But then we're getting into actual legitimate court cases where panties are being held up, or the victim's blood alcohol content is being put forward as evidence, like it matters that they were drunk. There needs to be a big overhaul in the justice system on how we treat rape cases. It's very frustrating for everyone involved on a victim's side to be coming up to a court case and being like, what'll they be asked? Are they going to be asked?
Can
this?
You see why some victims decide that they just can't do that?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I have always said since I came forward, mind yourself. If you don't want to report, it's no one should be able to tell you differently. No one should be able to tell you, you need to get this rapist off the street. That is not your responsibility.
It's not your responsibility,
no.
Yeah.
But I will say, go to SATU. You do not have to, and this is a big misconception, you do not have to go to the guards to go to SATU.
So you should be entitled to your healthcare and to make sure
Absolutely.
That you're safe and that there's not going to be any long-term repercussions for you. People shouldn't think that has to involve the guards.
Yeah. As another thing, SATU is completely free and it's completely confidential. Your name is on no file. There is a number that is assigned to your file and that's what you're known as throughout that system. No one can track you down. The people who work in SATU are the closest thing we have to angels.
Dominique, how are you doing now? How's day to day, every day for you?
It's all right. I find my anxiety is very
high.
Very high all the time. Recently lost a job and it was more or less because I was so anxious I couldn't
perform.
Yeah. I couldn't perform the stuff that I needed to do in the job. It's getting very hard to just be on the dole constantly, and that's the main effect is that I can't work. Every time I think I've got a job, I find that this is just, it's too hard. And my dad has a saying that I have banned in the house is always keep fighting. I'm tired of fighting. I'm fighting all the time to just be normal.
I wanted to bring you back to that, because I think when you say that young person came up to you and said that they're having a problem because of their religious views, and you say that you can understand that, and I think probably the reason you can understand it is because in a way you couldn't understand being gay yourself, and you had never met anybody who was gay. You had no terms of reference. You had no role model, somebody that you could see how they had gone through it, and you really had a very long and hard journey, I guess, to self-acceptance.
I did, and when I was brought up in a small community in West Wales, went to chapel, went to Sunday school, an only child, brought up in a very old-fashioned, close-knit community. And I was brought up, and then you're taught by your mum and dad or people around you, and that, you know, when you get older, you get a girlfriend, you get married, you get kids, you become grandparents, and that's the way the world keeps on going round. And then all of a sudden, here I am at 19, 20 years of age, having had a girlfriend at the time, and realising, oh my God, you know, what's happening to me here? Why am I on occasions at the time finding myself attracted to men. That this is not what's supposed to happen.
And
this
you
is
really
not right.
Didn't want to be gay.
And I didn't want to be gay. And that then started the issues of mental health issues, getting deeply depressed and the bulimia as well. And then I started going to the gym because I'd lost a lot of weight through being bulimic, started using steroids. And it led then to that night where, you know, when I did something I would regret for the rest of my life, when I left a note for my mum and dad and said, like, I can't carry on my life anymore. And that's something I have to live with, and something I'll regret for the rest of my life. And, you know, I'll never forgive myself for what I put my mum and dad through when they got up that morning and thought they were never going to see their only child again. And I was very lucky. I got a second chance. I got airlifted to hospital in Carmarthen, where I spent a couple of days in intensive care. And the doctor came around and said, look, you're a very, very lucky young man. Another 20, 30 minutes and it'd been too late to save you. And
your mom said something very, very profound to you after that, didn't she? And I think, not to put words in your mouth, but
that's what saved my life.
But I presume that's what took you from there to the point you're on now. Tell us about that.
But people came to visit in hospital. My family, friends came. Mum and dad came, and people asking, "Are you okay? And if you want to talk about it?" And I just didn't. Just still didn't tell anybody. And feeling a sense of shameness now. You know, a sense of feeling weak. That weakness, scared of being found out because I was different to what I was brought up to be. Mm. And then people came to visit, and people left. And my mum came back after everybody gone one night, and she came back and she said to me, "Look, if you ever do anything like that again, then you may as well take me and your dad with you because we don't want to live our life without you." And she left, and that's all she said. And I just started crying for what I had, the hurt I'd put through, the people that mattered to me most. And I started crying in the hospital bed, and I said to myself, look, I need to accept who I am. And that's when I realised, and this is what I try to tell people.
My full name is John Doyle, and I live in 31 Connell Drive in Newbridge. I've been a postman 13 or 14 years, and it's a job that I really, really love.
Tell me how it has changed over the last couple of weeks since coronavirus came into our world.
Well, it's a very nervy time for everyone, not alone old people or vulnerable people, but everyone. Everyone is very, very nervous about it. And we're all keeping our distance. We're all washing our hands. I never washed my hands as much in my life before. But we have to do it. Keep our distance, but talk. And if we have a smile on our face every time we meet a person on the road, like we're the most important people out on the road now at the moment. And if an old person that's vulnerable is standing out in the road, just stop and say hello and say, weather's lovely, how are you today? And a few words like that goes a long way.
Can really brighten up someone's day. Tell us, there's a few vulnerable people living on their own on your route, and you've been kind of taking special care of them, as On Post have advised all postmen and postwomen to do. Tell us what you're doing.
Well, I have three customers that are vulnerable that won't come out of their houses, and they're in three different areas. But I've talked to them about messages, you know, they're shopping and all that sort of thing, and they're okay for shopping. It's just that they love the newspaper, and I'm delivering the newspaper to them, even if I haven't got the post. If I've no post for them, I'll walk in, I'll hand them the newspaper at a distance, and they love to see it coming. Because they're in their houses, they're actually locked in, and they're not coming out, they're afraid to come out. But I said, I'd do it. And one man said to me, how many days a week would you do it? I said, I'll do it as many as you want. I said, I'll do it 5 days a week that I'm on it. And I handed that man his paper this morning, and he went to pay me for it. And I said, no.
You wouldn't take any money?
No. Because I'm part of a family out here. I feel I'm like a family out here, and the people are just fabulous. There's a man in Kilcullen there. He's a postman, and he's actually buying milk and bread before he comes into work in the mornings, and putting them in a box and going delivering them to customer, his own customers. It just gives them a bit of satisfaction that there's someone around and there's someone calling into them.
And that's the thing, lots of people aren't seeing anyone now from one end of the day to the other, which goes against really Irish people and the way we normally deal with one another. We're all so friendly usually. So to see your face, you could be the only face that they're seeing.
Well, we can't shake hands with one another. And we're a nation that hugs one another and loves one another. But we just can't, we can't shake hands. I love the kids now. The kids come out and they're talking, ah, there's the postman, honestly. And you go to shake hands and then you pull your hand back. It's a strange thing, but it's very nerve-wracking. And people have to be very careful. If we're doing things, we'll give it at a distance, and we'll say, "Are you okay?" I'll check with the people about their papers, and I also check that they have enough food and a whole lot. And they say they're grand with food, but they just love the paper.
And of course, you're giving out the helpline for a loan, which I'll give out again later on. And you've been told by On Puss to give out that helpline if someone is really struggling on their own and they need help.
That's right. We tell the vulnerable people that helpline is there. We give them the number, and they work away from there. You know.
And John, have you ever seen anything like this in your lifetime? It's such a strange time, isn't it?
In my lifetime, I've been working. I'll have 40 years working done this time next year in different companies. I've never seen this. I've never seen the likes of this. And we just have to rally together, everyone, let it be young, old, middle-aged, we all have to rally together and mind ourselves and look after one another and call into a person that's lonely. Knock on the door, stand back and say, "Are you all right?" Put the smile on their face. And if young people and middle-aged people did more of that and stand back and realise what the way old people live now, it'd be a better world.
Well, listen, mind yourself while we go through the next couple of weeks, and thanks for talking to us, John.
I'm delighted to have done it now. And I want to say one thing, just one thing. The nurses and the doctors and the surgeons and the nurses in nursing homes, the best of luck in what you're doing, because you're keeping this country going, and keep well, keep safe, and thanks very much.